succession with 32327, Reel 1.
Meg Parks, Sunday 1st of April 2007. Could I please ask you to state your name, age, branch of service and rank, please?
Sir, Hugh Cecil Jones, age 91 and a half, branch 6 heavies, Royal Artillery. What else?
And your rank?
Oh, promoted in the field, sergeant.
Thank you. May I ask you, Cyril, where, when and how were you captured?
I was, when we left Singapore for Java, or Sumatra at first, they formed a paratroop company belonging to the Dutch. And I was happened to be a paratrooper, passed out as a paratrooper, going back to my regiment. And they hadn't formed the paratroop company in those days, in the early days of the war. Then we did some sorties over Sumatra and Java, and the last sortie was very uncomfortable for us all. There were 24 of us in the plane. The pilot got scared and he went much too high, signaled us to come out, and I always made the point of coming out first, because very often if there were troops on the ground, it's, you know, troops coming and you'd be shot in the air. So therefore, anyway, the this time we were signalled to come out, and it was far too high, and there was a wind blowing. 24 of us, 22 got dropped in the sea, and 2 of us in the jungle. The boys in the sea lost the lives, of course, and I came down in the jungle, and I'd never met the other chappy, but I'd been told he did survive. And it was there, of course, that I met my little friend. My parachute, unfortunately, didn't work, and I came crashing down on a tree, struck a leg in, and I was badly, very badly wounded. And I couldn't get to my pocket to get my jackknife. Eventually I did, cut myself off and dropped down to the ground. And I don't know how long I'd been there really, but this little chappy came along and he had one look at me, this little monkey, and he ran away. Anyway, he came back. He must have seen the likeness, evidently. And he befriended me straight away. And the next thing I knew, he was rolling a coconut for me, and I was dying for a drink. And I'm sure that saved my life.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can carry on with a little chappy, of course, if there's any need to be.
Hmm.
Then he carried bananas and any fruit he could get hold of, and one particular day he was staying with me all the time after that, and he brought me some bamboo shoots, and I just looked at them and I said, anyway, he sat in front of me and he made me look at him, bless him, and he peeled this bamboo and ate it. As good as to say, now you try that now, just do the peeling. And I ate and it was beautiful, the bamboo shoots. And that, anyway, that's the story of the little monkey. And Eventually, we got out. And unknowing to me, of course, the Dutch had capitulated.
Right.
So I couldn't stand. I was on all fours. The two of us were all on all fours. And I walked straight into a Japanese. Anyway, in a few days after that, they flew me out to a hospital in Singapore. The hospital I was in Java by now, and the hospital there, the Japs had gone in and they'd killed all the nurses and destroyed all the implements. So
may I just stop you and ask, you were in the jungle in Java?
Yes.
And the Japanese took you to hospital?
Yes.
I see.
To Singapore.
So they actually took you from Java by plane?
Yes. And then?
This would be in March 1942? Because the capitulation was
right.
The 9th
yes,
of March.
It was.
So it would be after
yes.
that.
Yes. And I suppose this is where the mistake of me being dead. I wasn't on the roll in Singapore, and I was on the roll in Java. And anyway, they found that out, and they bundled me back to Java before we went to Japan.
Right. So how long were you in Singapore for when you went to the hospital there? What happened
about
there?
3 months. In Changi.
In Changi?
Yep. After the... They didn't keep her long in hospital.
Which hospital did they send you to in Singapore?
Oh dear, Royal. It's in that book.
All right.
Yeah.
Not to worry.
It doesn't come again.
Yes, it's...
We can look at that.
Have a look in the first page. The Royal Alexander.
Right.
Then, after a few, about a fortnight, I think, I went to Changi. And eventually they found out I wasn't on the roll in Singapore, and I was sent back to the regiment in Java. And from Java...
Which camp were you in Java? Where did they send you to?
Tanjung Priok, in Batavia. Jakarta now, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. And from there, roughly 1,000 of us were detailed one day to get our pack, what pack we had together. And... We boarded a ship called the Singapore Maru, and we didn't know where we were going, of course, at that time. But what really happened was had an injection before we went on the ship, and what for? Nobody knew anything. But you may, like I have done, come to conclusions. Within 3 days, I was been on the ship. Cholera and dysentery broke out. I maintain that they were responsible for it, and the boys were dying at the rate of 35 to 40 overnight, and they were thrown overboard. And of course, we were sick as well. We were there in that terrific stench and down the hold, and we didn't want to go. What food there was, it was just rice, and we weren't used to it at that time. In Java, we were able to get to the warehouses where the Dutch had, of course.
And these warehouses were on the docks, were they?
Yes. Then, and we worked on the docks anyway. For a part, and then I was driving the Japs round the island afterwards whilst we were there. They couldn't handle the big things, the big wagons. So then there was a duck farm like buyers of any amount of their cakes, so I can always make a meal with an egg and cheese. They were Edam cheese enough to sink several ships, so we were all right. And tin stuff, of course, the Japanese didn't like them, so we had them. And then eventually we got to Japan. We had to stop in Formosa. We were too near the land to bury the dead, and went on to Japan, disembarked, and then we had to walk about 20 miles. And if you fell ill or collapsed in any way, you were bayoneted and left there. Anyway, eventually we got to camp, and after we had 2 days respite, and they took us down to see the pit. It was a mine drift, and there we were, and sorry to say, but I had a very short fuse, and I misbehaved when somebody thumped me. I thumped them back. So I did the same with the Japanese. And I had 28 days solitary confinement.
May I ask what was the name of that first camp in Japan?
It was in Motoyama. I don't think there was a name to it.
But it was the camp at Motoyama.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay.
So and it, the Motoyama area, it's rather not a very nice name to say, Fukuoka. It's a mining area. And there were several mines there. Of course, it was a drift we were in. And we did, we had reveille about 6:30, and we left camp about 7 to 7:30, and then we didn't return until about 6:30 at night. We had a stint to do of, we'll say, 3 yards wide and 3 yards in. Well, right, some of your colleagues, they were ill, and we were losing weight. We were a pitiful sight, and you couldn't leave your comrade without helping him. If you'd finished, you'd go and help somebody else. So we all came out together. But I was promoted to timberman. That was going up and down the coal face, watching that the timber was safe. And then if I was finished and everything all right and the blood's nearing completion, I could leave, go up. And this particular day I went up, and there was some South Korean forced labour in a camp close to us, next door to us actually, and the women folk worked down the pit. And this particular day, young girls, they were feeding, breastfeeding the children, and the children were waiting at pit head for them. And when I arrived up, I saw a young woman being beaten up, held by her breast. Again, I'm slamming her against the wall. Well, I said, no one can do that to any woman, colour or not. So I went for this guard, and I pulled him with one hand and pushed him. Well, right. Well, I had 48 days solitary confinement, and they paralysed me.
And so
12 months. I was paralyzed, I was lying down, I couldn't. The only thing that was going, and it's still going, is my mouth. Still, here we are. So
you say you were working down the mine, you were doing the timbering.
Yes.
What about general camp life when you weren't working? What were you able to do? Did you have rest days?
Yes, every 10 days. They were changing over the machinery or maintaining the machinery. And what maintenance it was. Electricity was very, very dangerous there. There were live wires everywhere. And many a day your battery would catch one of those and you'd be in the dark. So, and then, of course, there's always a beating at the end of every story. Whatever happened, right, this, and the beating came in. And I had 12 months anyway, paralysed, which helps in one way. But, if you don't work, they have less food, what food there was. Of course, the the food was more or less rationed. If you didn't work, you had less. Bowls of rice, cooked rice, but a good sized cup. You had three of those a day if you didn't work. You had five if you did. So we went down the pit. We weren't fit to go really, but for the sake of it, two bowls of rice, and they used to give you some warabushinsky. They used to call it some sort of pickle, and it was bitter or anything, made with carrot tops and chrysanthemums. And, because it told you, said it's fit to eat, and that's the end of it. You ate it. And then, the last 2 years, really, the meat we had were dogs, cats, and rats. And there was a special session for rats. We had, on our day off, we catching rats, and then we had to have them. It tasted all right. I mean, anything tastes all right when you're hungry, doesn't it?
Yes.
At that time, I'd gone down to 6 stone, and when I left Japan, I was 5 stone 6. And all Ned Kelly used to say, he said, "Eat 21 years in the services before we left for Japan," and he looked at me one day and he shouted, "Daft," he said, "what? If we ever get out of here and you go home, you knock on the door," he said, "there's nobody in, you can go into the letterbox," he said. So we hadn't lost our sense of humour. That was one thing. And I must say, in the early days, we made our own entertainment. We had a little concert party, and very fortunate, there was a chappie, he had a piano accordion, and he was from New Zealand, and we found out afterwards he was a musbach, and
he was a
musical bachelor of music,
right?
And he used to pick up. He just hummed or sang a piece of, because you see, being Welsh, and there was another Welshman from Festiniog, he's passed on some years now, but he had a beautiful tenor voice, and he was a soloist for the Male Welsh Choir in Glen Festiniog. And we used to sing duet together, hymns mostly. And but they went down beautifully. And then we hadn't got a padre with us, but we did have a, we made a little service reading from the gospel and sang a hymn, a little prayer, and we got through, but the numbers went there. The boys were passing away, bless them, and that ceased off. But Richie and I, we kept on. We made a point of twice or three times a year to have a service of some kind.
And you mentioned Richie. Was that your fellow Welshman's name?
That's right, yes.
What was his full name? Do you remember?
Richie Williams.
Richie Williams.
Yes.
And you mentioned the concert party. Who, did you take part in that, yes, or were you in the audience?
Oh, no, no, no.
So who would organise...
Front line at all times.
So who would organise the concert parties?
The mess people mostly. The cook and the chappies that worked in the cookhouse. I mean, they had a little more time. They didn't go down the pitch, really, did they? So, yes, we managed to entertain. We had a black and white minstrel show and black and the chaps used to enjoy it. Unfortunately, we had one of the guards, he was a Christian, and we could explain to him, and he transmitted to the others, what a Bible was, what a hymn book was. So, and I think his name was Yamamoto. Yamamoto-san. And I'm sure he's still smoking our cigarettes. He had cases and cases of cigarettes. And he never once rose a hand to anybody. He just mumbled something sometimes, but no, never.
Did you get Red Cross parcels?
We saw them, and they offered us one tin of corned beef, 12-ounce tin of corned beef between 24 men. And officer, I just can't remember his name now, but he stammered, bless him. He was from Wales, from Newport, and he went to the guard room and he said he wanted the bloody lot on him at all, he said, and we never saw him after, bless him. And they took all the officers over there. The officers didn't work. So we had one officer, which was an interpreter. He was Mr. Trillwood, RAF. And the RAF and the Army didn't fit in very well.
So tell me about the relationships between officers and men in the camp. Were they...
Oh, no, we didn't see them.
You didn't see them?
No. Whether I should say this or not, I'm not sure, but I'm going to say. When we first went there, we had the one officer in particular, and I'm not going to mention his name, but he sided with the Japanese. We weren't working hard enough, we weren't doing this, and when we came back, he put us on Junkers. Right, I said. And it came my turn to take the lads down as an NCO. And they got a pack. They got their pack, but there's nothing to put in the pack, so I put stones in them. And I was to drill them. I said, take your packs off, I said, when we got down to the parade ground, and sit on them. Down he came. Oh, let loose that. You are on a charge. And I flatly refused to I told him then that, I'm sorry, I said, you're an officer, but you're in the same boat as we are. But you don't work, and we do. And I'm not going to drill these chappies in a prison war camp. And I refused to act. He said, you'll be on the charge. But unfortunately, he didn't come home. He went overboard somewhere. I don't know.